Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sangari. Last week at this time, we spent the hour talking about wine. Pair what you learned last week at this time with what you're going to learn in the next hour, and you're going to make someone very happy on Valentine's Day. We get to talk to this person Wednesday afternoons on the afternoon news service, and hearing him speak for even a few minutes opens up a mini universe of culinary knowledge. We get him for the full hour this morning. Chef Michael Clody is the owner of Michael's on the Hill in Waterbury Center. Chef Michael, it's always a pleasure getting to speak with you and learning about food. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Listeners, this is a great time to ask some questions about cooking. Maybe you have a roast and you'd like to know the best way to prepare it, or need a suggestion of what to serve with your entree. You can call in and speak with Chef Michael. Our number is 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Chef, when making a romantic dinner, are there do's and don'ts?
Don't try to impress. That's basically it. Like, yeah. Try to do the best you can, but when you think you're doing the best, that sort of comes with an expectation that everybody's going to love it. But if you do something new, you're probably not going to be very good at it, as it is with new things. So the best thing to do is to do whatever it is that's really in your repertoire, because everybody's got something in their repertoire, right? I mean, if this is, again, like a lasagna, or if this is a spaghetti bolognese or tomato sauce or whatever it is that you do best, do that, right? And don't experiment, because the experiments, for that you have your family, really, during, like my mom used to come up with new things, and then she would give it to the family, and then look how we respond to it. And once in a while, it was a great hit, so it became her repertoire to keep doing it. And then some things were just, you know, so for that said, like, the same thing goes for the restaurant. Like, there's nothing on the menu that we haven't done before. So being experimental as a chef is great, but do these experiments behind the scenes until you realize, like, this is, because our what you feel in your mouth and what you taste, is a little bit universal first, the same as wine when you're talking about wine.
Yeah.
But then it's really hard to say, like, what you're supposed to like and what you don't, because we're so individual in itself too. But when it comes to flavor profiles, as it is salty, fat, sugar, and whatever, I mean, fast food chains have, you know, created this. It's not a new creation. This has been same as fine dining as it is in fast food. And neither of it you should have every day. Right? Because it is based on that, what tastes good, what feels good. And so for that, it's just you need to keep learning and keep tasting new things. So when you come up with new ideas and new things, make them and eat them yourself and be really critical to yourself. And when you eat it, be like, well, what I'm feeling and what I'm tasting right now, someone else will too. And that's why you're putting yourself out there, because if you do something that you like and someone else might not, that doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that the tastes are different.
Yeah.
But I would suggest do something within your repertoire.
I'm also thinking you don't want to serve something like a saucy pulled pork sandwich that you'll wind up wearing all over your face when you're trying to, you know, be kind of suave and romantic, right?
Well, I mean, that depends. I mean, you know, again, what do you consider being romantic? If you both eat a sloppy Joe and you both are kind of messy, that can be romantic. Or as I said, if you want to eat something that's really highly garlic, just make sure it's both of you that might eat it. If you later on go for a kiss and one did not have any garlic or any of the strong flavors, it might be a little blue cheese or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I think the most romantic thing is whatever you share together. But I've always been like that too, where it's like the food is almost secondary. It's with who you're spending it with. Same in a restaurant too. Like, I can try to make yourself a really great evening, but if you want to set yourself up for a great evening, choose the company properly first. Because that's what you're going to spend the next 2 hours or 3 hours with, and the conversations you're going to have. So again, make it romantic. If you start talking about politics, or you're going to start talking about certain things that can create, you know, excitement or even hostility, you might want to just lay off on those a little bit and talk about the weather and talk about skiing and talk about things you like doing rather than things that we need to agree upon or else we're not going to get along. So as I said, conversation, company, and the food needs to match. And with the company and the conversation in a restaurant, I don't have anything to do with that. Right. So your night can become really great for just the conversations you had.
I love that I'm getting not only cooking advice, but dating advice from Chef Michael this morning.
Yeah. Romance is not talking. Romance is listening.
Yeah, no
kidding.
You know,
you don't learn anything when you talk. You only learn when you listen. So.
Good point. Do you remember the first time that you cooked a dinner to impress a woman?
You know, I started so early in the kitchen that just even dating wasn't even on the thing yet. I mean, I started doing dishes when I was 12 years old.
Wow.
So later on in the kitchen, I already knew sort of what's going on. And when I fell in love with my wife now, we were already in the kitchen. We met in the kitchen that I learned in. And she came from America to be on her externship from the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. So she was already a chef as well. So for me, it was... You know, at my house, we did a lot of grilling. It's kind of funny in Switzerland, but we have a huge fire pit behind our house in Switzerland. And so I would always grill stuff, and that was just my favorite thing. And still until now, one of my favorite meals is just a nice grilled, either a piece of fish or a grilled piece of steak and some grilled bread. I love grilled bread. So just the simple things. And as I said again, this is what you're going to do. What's your repertoire? If this is what you do, and this is who you are. And if you want to expand it, that's beautiful. Knowledge is great. Go out there and explore food, wine. Oh, goodness, that's the beauty of life, right? Mm-hmm. It's just you can do whatever you want. And you know, the interesting part is one of the hardest questions to answer is, what do you want?
Right.
What do you want? What do you want out of life? What do you want for dinner? What do you want for dinner? What do you want for lunch? Mm-hmm. And then you have to think about it. And again, you put your own self on the line saying, you know, I want to make this for my loved one. I want to make this for my family, and I'm going to put myself out there and then see what happens. And then you just got to be strong when somebody, you know, you do got to, it's usually when someone puts something in their mouth, between the time of when they put it in their mouth and the response time, between you get a response, usually says everything.
Yeah.
So either you see the eyes light up or you don't. And when they don't, then it's sort of like, yeah, it's okay, you know, this and that. It's almost like with little kids, you know, when kids get hurt, you measure the pain between the thump and the crying of how bad it actually is. When the crying comes instantly, it's usually not that bad. When there's like a break in between, when the kid actually has to grasp for air, you know, oops, something really happened here. They really hurt themselves. So same thing goes with food. It's that little bit of a break right between when they start eating it and the first facial expressions come over their face.
Well, we're talking to probably a lot of people who are just, you know, home cooks, amateur cooks this morning. And I know you've got the training and you cook with such confidence and verve. But for the rest of us, you know, it's one thing to be cooking for ourselves. I do a lot of cooking for myself and every meal is almost excellent, chef. Excellent. But, you know, when it comes to cooking for someone else, that is a real, hill to climb. I'm always worried. So how does one kind of build the confidence in their cooking to, you know, be confident in sharing it?
Right. So basically your mouth is not really hard to explain of what goes on in there, because it's basically our attention span as we have. If we just would stop talking for 3 or 4 seconds, people would start thinking about changing the channel.
Right.
So the same thing goes for your mouth. You can have the best thing you ever tasted, but you're tasting it over and over and over. It gets boring really quick. So you have a couple of things that need to be, we call this in the kitchen, we call this a balance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You need to balance it out. It can be too sour. You might want to make it a little sweeter. That can be honey, can be sugar, can be just some caramelized onions. You carry this over, so you have something sour. So if you put it in your mouth, what do you taste? And if you have a little sweet and sour in your mouth, oh, perfect. But if you also have soft, you need to have something else too, like a little crunchy. Right. Like a perfect example is like a butternut squash soup, right?
Right.
I mean, it tastes like baby food when you actually eat it. And it can
true.
Be beautifully balanced. Again, you put in apple cider, and you put in a little apple cider vinegar, and you put in, you know, a little bit of maple syrup for the sweetness and whatever.
Right.
But if you keep eating that, then all of a sudden you feel like, I'm not a baby, I would like a little something. So you put in like some spiced creme fraiche like we have on the menu right now. So it's just, you balance it with a little bit of cream, a little bit of spices, and then some crunch. You put in some toasted pumpkin seeds.
Yeah.
So again, when you eat it, know what you're looking for. So if you put something in your mouth and it's just soft, think about it. Maybe a piece of grilled bread, maybe some crunchy, some fried onions, whatever it is that you want to balance this with. And again, you need to balance this out. So all these components come together. And that's when you call it a perfect bite. Is when all these come together. Mm. You have a little bit of crunch. You have a little bit of soft. You got some salty. You got some sugar. You got some of this and some. So it balances it out in your mouth. So that's what's going to make you like, oh, I want more. I want more of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Gets you through that whole bowl rather than just, eating that baby food. Right. What are some ingredients, good ingredients that you like cooking with right now, Chef?
So we were always told, like right from the beginning on, so your biggest thing is salt, right? So it's the first component that, I mean, it was great when they found out about salt. I mean, when they realized that the ocean has salt water, and you can just cook with that. There's actually some restaurants that cook with seawater. So it's already salted, so when you actually have seawater and you cook spaghetti in it, they're already seasoned. It's kind of cool. So
nice.
Seasoning, and it's just, how do you find out what someone likes? Yet again, we get to the part of, are you more interested in expressing yourself or learning from the one you are with? And for that, you just got to be quiet again and just watch. Because from the first date on, you go out, what is he or she ordering? What are they ordering, right? So that you can see what they like is, it's still French fries and chicken fingers. Now, there's nothing wrong with French fries and chicken fingers.
Right.
But as an adult, you might not only want to eat food like that. And by the way, let's go right into that. So you have this where you have the crunch and you have the salt and you have the texture, right? So a French fry can be one of the more perfect foods, right? Because you got the soft, you got the on the inside of the French fry, you got the crunchy on the outside, you have the salty, you have the fat from the fryer, so you have all these components right together. So that's why is a French fry so great, right? I mean, I personally think that a burger done well can be one of the most perfect foods.
Mm-hmm.
Yet again, you take the layers, right, of your soft bun, and please, if you make a burger, make it a soft bun. You know, in Vermont, it was about 10 years ago, everybody started serving it with focaccia. I think it's one of the worst ideas you could have ever had, because my gums never stopped bleeding from, like every time you took a bite, it scratched your palate.
Right.
So it's a soft bun. It's a potato bun. It's a brioche bun. It's whatever soft. And then you go in with the crunchies. You get lettuce. Some do with some onions. Some do it with, so you can really layer all that. And again, when you're taking apart, even in a fine dining sense, a burger, you put everything together. This is every sandwich for that matter. You really put that all together. A little bit of crunch, a little bit of salt, a little bit of fat, of course, and a little bit of, so everything mixed together.
Gosh, I'm so hungry already. Michael, let's start kind of, maybe building a little meal for Sunday, for one loved one to the other. And I want to start with appetizers. So I look at your current menu, and there are a couple items that the non-professional could attempt on Sunday, and it's not the duck liver mousse, and it's not the roasted mushroom tartine, but I think someone could have fun making the cress with Bailey Hazen Blue, the almonds, the crispy pancetta, and the quince dressing. So tell us about that.
So, by the way, we can talk about the duck liver mousse.
Okay.
You know that this, everything that is in cooking comes from, or a lot of times, comes actually from very, how would you say that, poor environment, right? So
right.
from people that didn't have poverty or farmers or whatever you had.
Peasant
and
cuisine.
So when the liver mousse basically is nothing else but just liver. Of course, you got to have liver, right?
Right.
And because it's so high in protein, it will bind. And heavy cream, onions, garlic, salt and pepper, right? Mm. And brandy, if you want to put that in there, you can have some brandy. But when you have a recipe, just go follow the recipe, but that's pretty much all it is you roast off the duck liver, you hit them with the brand, you deglaze it with it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you have the onions, the garlic, the cream reducing just a little bit, and then you mix it together and you blend it. And then you got to strain it because you want to get all these little particles out of there. So we call that a tammy. It's basically a flat strainer, but you just got to strain it out, let it cool, and it gets to be this mousse. That's it. I mean, seriously, there's like five ingredients, and that's it. But when you want to talk about the dressings, so quince dressing, we took quince when it was in season, usually kind of late in the year. We take the fruit, and the quince is a fruit you can't eat by itself. So you chose actually something that is more knowledge-bound than anything else. I love quince jam, and I love quince in itself. So when you have to cook it, so basically you have to either cook it in sugar, what then creates the jam, or you got to cook it in a little bit of liquid. That's what we do with the dressings. You take the fruit, you peel it, you take the fruit, you cut it, and you cook it in a little bit of liquid with some spices, and then you make the dressing out of that. So it's actually not, the dressing is sort of like harder, but as I said before, you need something sweeter, and a quince tastes sort of like a pear. It's like a pear and an apple mix. But when you have it, so that you have the sweet, right? So now you need to bring the vinegar in there, right?
Oh, okay.
So you have the quince, you got the vinegar, you got a little bit of mustard for some heat, a little spice, you know, and then you put, you know, the olive oil in it. Now, with olive oil, if you go really extreme olive oil, just straight up beautiful olive oil, when you make a dressing out of that, you'll sometimes run into that it becomes too bitter.
Right.
Right, so you can take a mix, go a 25-75 mix with olive oil and canola oil or olive oil and vegetable oil, whatever it is. I always say that when you have high quality material, like a really expensive olive oil, just drizzle that right over the salad. And this is what I'm trying to tell you here. When you start really getting involved in produce and olive oil and blue cheese and whatever, so you so happen to live in a state that makes some of the most perfect cheeses, right?
Right.
So it is more the identification of what already is great, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you pick an apple, right? How do you pick a pear? How do you pick a cheese? By just buying it and eating it and then be like, oh, this tastes like this. Oh, this tastes like that. We already talked about that before. When somebody says, oh, I don't like mushrooms or I don't like scallops, that can totally as well be, or it can also be that you never had it done properly.
Right.
So go keep trying it anyway, because sometimes it's that these mushrooms were just, you know, out of a can, or I'm not sure what you consider a mushroom to be. And that's what it is. What do you consider something to be? And a scallop, too. If a chef overcooked it or steamed those scallops instead of putting a beautiful caramelized crust on it by just its own protein and sugar. So what I'm telling you is, don't have someone else mess it up for you by saying, oh, let me stop here. My knowledge is good enough. I'm going to go with this. So my father-in-law, rest in peace, said he hates salmon and he hated mushrooms.
Yeah.
And guess what I made one day? Actually, I was working in a restaurant in New York, and he came in. It was on the tasting menu. So he got it, not even choosing it, really. So he got it, and he fell in love with it. Because, see, between a properly cooked salmon and an overcooked piece of salmon, it's the same as a properly cooked chicken breast as an overcooked chicken breast. One can be juicy and tasty, and it's just enough texture in your mouth. Overcook it, and it turns into a different dish, and this is maybe what you like. Maybe you do like it dry. It's like eating a steak, full on, well done. There is, you can have the same plate, but it's a different meal. And I'm not trashing people. That
right. I get that.
Well done. It's totally different.
Yeah.
So for you, it's to find out, when I have it a different way, do I still like it, right?
Yep.
Or maybe I like it more. And so experimenting in life is so important. Experiment with eating, experiment with cooking. And, you know, we keep talking about how to make a menu or cook for someone else. Do you know what's even more romantic? Why don't you do it together?
Yes.
You know?
No doubt.
So Laura and I are dabbling in making Asian food because it's something that's really not in my repertoire, right?
Right.
So I wanted to find out. I love, like, mushu pork, and I love Peking duck. Now, for me to get Peking duck up here, it's a little tough, but I got excess of duck breast. So we use duck breast and just sear those off, and then we make those pancakes.
Mm.
And when I realized how easy it is to make those pancakes in your home, I mean, wow. Or make your own tortillas, or make your own things. And just that is so cool when you finally go into a place where you're not comfortable in, right? But you still do it. You know, and Laura and I did those pancakes, and we served, because for COVID, we had the entire family here at my house for a long time.
Right.
And so we did it. And at the end, the outcome was so great because it was just exactly what you would get in a really good Chinese restaurant.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, you talk about salmon. You know, one of the things that makes a dinner wonderful and romantic is not always cooking together, but I used to date a woman chef who made us order in tandem, and you'd eat half your dish, and then you would switch. And up to that time, I was not a salmon fan. She was, and just about every time we went out, she ordered salmon, you know, a different way, and I learned to love it. So I was exposed to it, cooked properly, and I actually fell in love with, you know, eating salmon and so many other things. So,
sometimes, for me, if you have an ingredient that can be eaten raw, I'm not saying you go out there and buy a cheap piece of fish. If you want to get some sushi-grade salmon, go ahead. You can talk to Ed at Stowe Seafood, or you can go to your fishmonger and say you want some sushi-grade salmon. Mm-hmm. But you can eat it raw. And again, that's not for everybody. But what I mean is you can also eat beef raw, like you have steak tartare, right? So anything you can eat raw, you pretty much can only overcook, right? So if this is – but this is now becomes – and this is what the whole thing is. It's texture. Right, so we fall in love with texture as well, or the hatred thereof. Whatever you can love, you can also hate. If you want to put the same amount of investment into hating something, it causes just about the same amount of love. So, when you learn about texture, when you eat an oyster, a raw oyster, do you like that texture? Do you like that beautiful first hit of sea salt? Like, I love oysters, right? And I love that, just that fresh, that. You know, when you're a kid and you run into the ocean, I come from Switzerland, it's the first time you hit that salt water and you forgot that it's salty.
Oh, right.
You get this full mouth full of salt water. But, you know, at this moment, probably someone on a beach or someone on an island, whatever, you are somewhere where it's like on vacation. Usually for me, salt water always meant you're either on vacation or something.
Now, hey, Chef, we're going to have to take a quick break. Hold that thought. We're going to be right back. I'm going to take a moment to get a CBS News update. Listeners, if you'd like to pop in to talk to Chef Michael from Michael's on the Hill, our numbers, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can ask him a question, maybe share a wonderful dinner you've had at Michael's on the Hill, and we'll be back right after the CBS News update on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly, the Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I once made a Valentine's Day dinner for a woman I was dating that included a beautiful cold pink soup of some sort, you know, lobster, asparagus with rosemary, and some dessert item that I probably bought. I cook, but I rarely, if ever, bake. The lobster and the soup were first attempts. They turned out fine. The effort was greatly appreciated. If you're thinking of making something special for someone special this weekend, we've got just the person to give you some guidance. Our dear friend and amazingly creative Chef Michael of Michael's on the Hill is with me this hour. To ask him a question or to make a comment, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. And, Chef, we got this email from Tim. He said, air fryers can make weekly meals taste healthy and fresh, but what are your thoughts on air fryers?
Every piece of equipment you're going to have, it depends on how you're going to use it. It's like a pilot. What equipment are you flying on? So it's everything is so different. Yes, you should, because if you have French fries, you can make them not necessarily in a fryer. You can also bake them in the oven. So you have an air fryer. I'm not familiar with air fryers. I'm really not. All I do is I see once in a while catch those infomercials on TV.
Right.
Whatever they pull out of those ovens on the TV is not what they cooked in that. I can guarantee you that. So when they take out like a whole roast of chicken and all that, I'm like, yeah, but that's so beautifully around like a rotisserie chicken but what I mean is, if you have an air fryer and French fries, and what I do sometimes is I make these steak fries, right? And all I do is take potatoes, cut them up, put a little bit of paprika on it. I like paprika on my on my potatoes. Maybe a little bit of seasoning if you want, like maybe some Old Bay seasoning, whatever you want
on
it.
Yeah.
And then a little olive oil, just a little bit of olive oil, just to get, I call it suntan lotion, you know, because it basically makes the heat go onto your food. So if you put it in dry, they will cook, but they're not going to brown.
Right.
So because of that, I put a little, just a couple drops of olive oil, toss them up, put them in the oven, and eat them like that. That's definitely much more healthy. Or when you make chicken, you know, chicken drumsticks or whatever you're going to cook with, if you roast them off, they will be healthier. That be said, again, if you put them in the fryer, you have fried chicken, there's just nothing like it. But that's a sacrifice you got to make sometimes, right?
Right?
There's a little bit of sacrifices you need to make because I would say a lot of us could probably lose a few pounds. And when you keep eating fried food, that is just going out right through your hips. It's going to go right to wherever you don't want it to go.
Right.
So an air fryer definitely helps you to be healthier. That goes for vegetables, too. So, you know, basically one of my favorite things is just grilled asparagus, right? Or,
yeah.
or grilled broccoli rabe. I mean, you can also broccoli rabe beautifully in the oven. Right? Turn your oven on, put a little olive oil on it if you want, a little salt and pepper, put it in the oven, roast them off, done.
Right.
I mean, finished. And now you have the texture you need because the broccoli rabe gets a little chewy, right? You don't want it overcooked. You want it crunch. Same as the asparagus. It gets a nice mix too, even if you have a steak or you have some, you know, some chicken breast or whatever, it gets this nice fresh crunch to it too.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Grant calling from Montpelier. Hi, Grant.
Yeah, hi. I got a question. You just touched a little bit about vegetables. My wife is trying to reduce carbs and trying to eat healthier and thinking about doing like a fish dish this Sunday. And I struggle with vegetables. I struggle trying to find things that complement the you know, the main course or the main, you know, piece of the meal, and I tend to get stuck with just roasted broccoli. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah,
so
Grant.
Basically, there's a whole lot of things out there that you can buy to make some really cool things. It's something you need to figure out. So there's like what's called cauliflower. What do they call it? Rice? They're not calling it rice. They call it something. It's like basically crushed up cauliflower.
Oh,
right?
Okay, right.
And that would make a really good, basically almost like a mashed potatoes. Of course, it's going to taste like cauliflower. So if you don't like cauliflower, might not be for you. But yeah, carbs really is, it's a big issue too, because you usually want to go vegetables. Look, vegetables should be the biggest part of your dish, right? But then every vegetable can be so different. So if you roast some butternut squash, that is, again, that softness you want when you have like mashed potatoes on your plate.
Right.
But what I mean is this, I don't like when people go, you know, like the fake and bacon or, you know, turkey bacon. Don't
right.
call it that. Just call it something else, because what goes in your head is bacon, or it goes in your head, mashed potatoes. No, it's never going to really be exactly like mashed potatoes, but it can be mashed butternut squash. It can be mashed cauliflower. And for that, you just need to, how would you say that? Learn how to appreciate it, right?
Right.
So basically, if you keep eating, so what your parents did, maybe even forcefully once in a while, for me was Brussels sprouts as a kid. I could not stand the Brussels sprouts. I'm blaming my mom for it as well, because she totally overcooks the Brussels sprouts, and when you overcook the Brussels sprouts,
right.
it smells like fart. So you don't want to eat something that smells like that. So what happened is I learned later on, and I'm serving them actually right now, little leaves of Brussels sprouts in the gnocchi. But they're just, again, little olive oil, salt, and pepper roasted in the oven. So go with those little principles and then the texture of it. Because sometimes I feel like we miss texture just as much as we actually miss the taste of it.
I think, Michael, if we take anything from this hour from you on Valentine's Day, the most important thing is do not make Brussels sprouts and overcook them, because your kitchen will smell like fart, and that could really turn off your loved one. I do want to ask you, I want to go back to salmon, which is a wonderful dish to make, and you offer there at Michael's on the Hill that beautiful roasted Faroe Island salmon. Salmon is always the one thing I'm not great at cooking. So what is the key to making salmon right? I mean, just so wonderfully like you do.
Okay, so the biggest secret on that is the same as a chicken. So we always called it in the kitchen that the skin is your religion, the religieuse. It's like you have to... There's a lot of people that take... The first thing they do with a piece of fish to rip the skin off.
Now, right.
Salmon skin crisps up so utterly beautiful. So here's how I cook a piece of salmon. I take it, I put it in a pan, I put a little olive oil in it, and you can use some good olive oil because you're never supposed to go, you'll never go really that far over that heat. Put the salmon in, make sure it's a nonstick pan, hopefully you have one, on very low heat, or my nonstick doesn't mean Teflon, but it's just, you have maybe a cast iron that doesn't stick, so whatever you want to use.
Mm-hmm.
Put that skin, season the fish, put the skin side down on the pan. And now, never flip that fish, the entire cooking process of what you're going to do.
Wow.
All right, so anything that is in high protein, meaning chicken, any fish, anything that has high protein in it, when you dry out that protein, it becomes chewy. Right? So in a salmon, if you want to keep it moist and tender, but with a nice crispy skin, take that, put it on the stove, right? Put it on a flame, not too high, like medium heat. See, the skin starts bubbling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you just make sure it's not stuck to the pan. If that skin's stuck to the pan, switch your idea, because now you're going to lose that skin, because that skin comes off so easily. So you basically will just take the fish off and then sear off the other piece and just leave the skin in there till it's, you can just scrape it off. But trying to make it, as I said, to non-stick in the pan. At this point, make sure the skin gets nice and brown. Mm-hmm. When it starts getting brown, put that in your oven. But again, with the skin side down, leave that skin on the down. Put it in the oven, bake it off. I would say probably about 7 minutes, 8 minutes, and you have yourself a beautiful medium rare piece of salmon. Mm-hmm. Go further, like 10 minutes, you're going to go into the medium. Of course, it depends on how big that piece of salmon is. And just keep checking it. It should really feel almost like a rare steak. But you feel the moisture in that fish. And then comes the other thing. You take it out, and then you flip it onto the skin side up. So the skin can now seriously crisp up by just touching the air. And now, the other trick is never put any sauce over that crispy skin for a long period of time, because that will make it soft again. Same with a chicken. When you have a nice crispy skin, don't put sauce over it.
Mm-hmm.
Just maybe a little garnish, maybe a little greens, or whatever it is, but don't put anything liquid on it. And then just that salmon. Another thing, too, people need to know that when you take it out of the heat or off the heat, it keeps cooking. Okay, so you heated up something on the outside to like 400 degrees.
Right.
That's going to keep cooking. It's what we call in the kitchen, you let it rest.
Right.
And every protein needs resting. So when I cook a steak and I cook it very beautifully rare and then send it to you like immediately, it's going to be pretty much raw. And that's not what you want. I mean, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's not. So what you do is a rare piece of steak takes just as long of cooking as a medium steak, but it's got to rest.
Hmm.
Right?
Yep.
So basically, you cook it to a temperature, take it aside, let it rest. Even let it rest until you have to maybe warm it up again, just for a quick second, put it in the oven, heat it up, put it on. But with the salmon, just, look, get a couple pieces of salmon, right? Might be a little bit of an investment. Look at it as being a little bit of cooking school.
Sure.
Cook one exactly the way you usually do, and if you keep on overcooking it, that means you're probably scared of undercooking it.
That's right.
So basically, cook three different ways. Pull one out that you say, like, oh, no, this is, like, totally going to be raw. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Second one, cook a little longer. Or maybe it is. And then you get this feel for, this is how it is. Look, a lot of cooking techniques were created by mistake. They actually were done, and then they realized, oh, this is how you do it. Oh, this is what it takes. Same as we said before, when you said, like, a pot roast, right? Or you said a roast.
Right.
You need to know, is this going to be something that needs to be in the oven for hours? Or does it need to be in the oven for a specific internal temperature, like a rib roast, right?
Right.
And then do you want that rib roast to be medium? You want it to be rare? You need it to... So YouTube makes a whole lot of videos. Some of them are good, some of them are not. Now you got to go figure out which ones are the good ones and which one are not.
Right. Michael, I want to talk a little bit about Michael's on the Hill. You're doing a take-and-bake meal, is that right?
We do have a take-and-bake meal, yes. So the difference is that... You can have takeout at any night. We start at 5 o'clock. And then you have take and bake, and we need, I think it's 48-hour notice. What that is you take it home, and then you heat it up. What that means is that the crab cake that you're going to take home, you make, they give you the crab cake, the salad dressing, and everything else, and then you put it together at home. But we're not doing it on Valentine's Day because we're just so booked that I can't put that more on top of it.
But you have a special menu for Valentine's Day?
Yeah, of course we do. So we're just going to celebrate. Again, actually, we're going to be a little bit on the lighter side because people are just choosing to just do eat a little bit lighter.
Yep.
This is a full menu, too. So we have the full a la carte menu at the restaurant. And on top of it, we have a beautiful specials. We start out with a Gruyere fritter. Basically, you know, how much better can it be if it's like, you know, creamy fried cheese. Served with a Riesling, a white wine, mayonnaise on the bottom of it. It's just this little bit of to dip in. And then we have a nice little arugula salad with duck prosciutto that I made in-house. We have a fig vinaigrette with that, made with dried figs. What else we have on there? Some pine nuts and some shaved Parmesan cheese on that salad. And then we go into a sorbet. We have a beautiful orange cranberry sorbet I made yesterday. And then a seared halibut or fennel whipped potatoes with preserved lemon, asparagus, and some crispy artichokes. And see, you can hear already in when I explain these foods, you can always find out, oh, that's what the creamy part is. Oh, that's what the crunchy part is. So that's what I'm always telling you, like, when you listen to someone, what you're actually hearing, and that's exactly what you're trying to recreate. Oh, and then we were talking about how romantic something is. Do you know what's the most romantic thing? What if, let's say, you said that she likes salmon, and you may not. How about you cooking some salmon just for her?
Yeah.
Right? You're actually cooking something that you are yourself not really willing to indulge in, and you make that for your partner. Same goes like when we talk about oysters. Like, he likes it, she does not. How about doing it like that, like, you know, someone else is different than you, tastes are different. And that I think, to me, is love, when you can just accept that someone likes something that you may not, but that does not mean you can't get along.
I agree. There's one thing I could listen to you talk about for hours on end, and I'll probably, after I ask you this, I'm probably going to go back and listen to the podcast on repeat. I want you to, I'm going to the dessert now, and tell us about the apple crostata. I love this.
Oh.
I love this more than life itself when you talk about the apple crostata.
All right. So what the crostata is, and the crostata dough, is basically a cookie dough. But we make it with almond flour. So anybody that's a nut allergy, that is not for you. Mm-hmm. And I can't take those out. So this is made with about a third almond flour and two-thirds of all-purpose flour. So you just make yourself a cookie dough. Basically, you take butter, sugar, and you cream that, and you add some eggs, and then you add the flour and this. So there's a recipe for it. So, and then you basically make this dough. You cool it, and the butter, when the butter cools, it becomes a moldable, like a cookie dough. And now you take some beautiful caramelized apples that have been seasoned with spices like cinnamon, cloves, allspice. So you roast that off with a little bit of butter, of course, a little maple syrup, and then you put that in the center when it's cold of that cookie dough, and you fold it around. You brush it with a little egg wash, and you bake it off in the oven. It's beautiful golden brown because it is a cookie dough. And then after that, we take some cloth-bound cheddar or whatever beautiful cheese, and the next cheese is going to be from Mansfield Creamery that goes on top, and you melt that in the oven. You bake it over it. Here comes the crunch. Basically, that cheese comes crispy on top.
Right.
And after that, we serve that with a honey cream, basically a pastry cream that is folded in with some whipped cream, a little bit of honey to make that a little bit sweet. Again, you don't want anything to be too sweet. I don't like when desserts are just sweet.
Right.
And we put a little bit of cider reduction on that. We take apple cider, and we just put it on the stove, and we boil it until basically you make sort of like a maple syrup out of it because it removes all the water. And what's left at the end is this beautiful caramelized sauce that tastes like cider. And we drizzle that on it. Again, it's more sour than it's actually sweet, to cut into this beautiful apple dish.
Oh, that is so fabulous. I love hearing that. And that is one of the most delicious things on earth right there. But I also see that you have a cheese plate as a dessert item. We often, you know, think of that as an appetizer. But, boy, that can be a really delicious, easy-to-prepare kind of a head dessert course, especially for a non-baker like me.
Right. So basically you can also usually you can take it as a dessert, you can take it as an appetizer, but you can also take it in between. Just make sure you might want to share it, or you don't kind of fill yourself up with with the cheese. Sometimes you get so much food already with the appetizers and everything else that then you don't get to the main course and you're already full. But the cheese plate, too, what we have is these local cheeses. We have right now, we have Breba from Barn First. That is a goat's blue. It has a little streak of blue on the inside. Then we have the Harbison, the Jasper Hill Harbison. Then we have cloth-bound cheddar, a block of cloth-bound cheddar on there. And then we have a Swiss one on there, too, because I do like that cheese. It's called a tête de moine. And tête de moine means the head, the monk's head. Okay? It's not a monk's head, don't worry about it. But it's a block of cheese. It's round. And what we do is we shave it with this piece of equipment we have in the kitchen called a girole. And what it does is you just shave it off the top, and it creates these florets. And the cheese itself is so beautiful, aromatic, that when you put it in your mouth, it just is like it just opens up. So that's the cheese comes from my native country. And then we just serve it with all kinds of dried fruits and a fig bread from Red Hand Bakery. That's an important thing, too, is the bread you put it on. And, of course, you always have the Levain from Red Hand on the table already as it is.
Right. Well, okay, so now we've learned two things. Don't always ask for the translation for some beautiful French word like tête de moine. Just accept it for what it is. And again, unless you really know what you're doing when it comes to Brussels sprouts, you want to, for a lovely meal with your loved one, avoid that, because overcooking them could make you blaming things on the dog, and we don't want to do that. You have such passion, such verve, and such great taste, Michael. We just love having you here every time to talk about cooking, and so keep doing what you're doing there at Michael's on the Hill.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. That's Chef Michael Clody. He's the owner of Michael's on the Hill. It's in Waterbury. And you can always hear him on Wednesday afternoons as well for a few minutes when he tells us what's going on at the restaurant on the afternoon news service with Brady Farkas. We've got CBS News next. And then next hour, we're going to chat with our national news correspondent, Bob Ney. That's first. We're going to follow that with Melissa Passanen from 7 Days. She'll join us to tell us, okay, if you didn't quite get everything down that Chef was telling you, there's takeout options on Valentine's Day. And then we're going to finish the hour at 10:30. We're going to talk to Kevin LePage, and he is a Vermonter who went all the way to finish in a top 10 finish in the Daytona 500. And, of course, the Daytona coming up this Sunday here on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. It's time to check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. He always brings us up to speed on the events that have been happening around the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Well, it's still in the news, still number one news item. So let's check in on what's happening with the COVID numbers.
Right. It's starting to morph a little bit, maybe to the positive side. Let's put it that way. Of course, there's the variants out there, but you know, with the total deaths worldwide globally is 2,365,000, basically, and the total deaths in America has now went to 475,000, which is very high, as you and I talk every week. But yeah, it does look like, you know, it's the beginning of some light at the end of the tunnel. the president has purchased 200 million more rounds of the vaccine, which is obviously, you know, very good. And they're even talked, the CDC changed its policy. If you have the full vaccine, you don't need to quarantine after exposure to someone who has had the infection. So that's another change in the last day or so. You know?
Yeah, With both those things, the purchase of more doses with the need not to quarantine, it certainly could mean that life is as normal as it can get, at least for the short term, could start to happen, and we might be able to travel a little more, go out a little more, and have the economy get back to somewhat of the normalcy that we knew before March of last year.
Right, and again, everybody's hopeful that by the summer, most people will be vaccinated, or at least the 75 to 80% of the people. It seems like, Rick, those people are coming around, too, that said they weren't going to get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. It seems like the percentages are starting to increase on people that say they will. Although, there's some disturbing trends in nursing home workers. In Ohio, 60% refuse to be vaccinated. So, that's, you know, statistically, it's been running that way around parts of the country also with nursing home employees for some reason.
And I know you mentioned that a few weeks ago, and it seems like that has remained steady, and I wonder why that is happening, because, yeah, you would think someone who is a frontline worker, especially in nursing homes, which are somewhat contained, and we've had outbreaks there, they would be more willing to roll up the sleeve and take the shot.
I would think, for everybody's protection, their own and the residents.
Yeah. I can't wait to get a shot, but, you know, that's just my decision for me. I still love to see people getting excited when someone in their family or themselves get one. But we've still got a way to go. If everything.
I get one on Monday, by the way.
You do? Oh, yes, congratulations. See,
my
I still.
My father's had his. He's 97.
Oh, wow. So with the extra doses being purchased and the rollout as it's going now, it seems to have picked up some momentum. Do we have a sense of when, you know, that 75 to 80% of the country will indeed be vaccinated?
Well, they're saying around the summer. Mm-hmm. Might be a little bit earlier, but they're saying around the beginning of the summer, I should say.
All right, and that's encouraging because there were times last year we did not know when we'd have a vaccine. We thought it would happen sometime this year, so... we like that. I would imagine you've been glued to the Senate impeachment trial. So what are your impressions so far, Bob?
Well, it's that talk about morphing. That is morphing. First of all, I think that the Democratic side, made an error one way, but did a good presentation. I think their presentation was good. Look, senators and are watching, you know, from both sides of the aisle. They're in the Capitol. They were in the Capitol that day. It's very emotional. You know, I was in the Capitol 11 years, just watching that on TV is emotional. And so I think that the way that the Democratic, presenters, managers of the impeachment presented it, I thought was very effective with the videos and showing where, you know, people were. And then, of course, the president's words, you know, at the rally and things. Right. I think the mistake they made, I still will argue this, it should have been sent over to the Senate on the very day the House impeached President Trump for a wide variety of reasons. It still would have been the complete heat of the moment, and also the fact that he was still president of the United States,
which makes it
different. But anyway, now I think that President Trump's initial presentation by his lawyers was an unmitigated disaster. Castor was terrible. He rambled off about all kinds of things, tried to make a couple of funny jokes, and he just was really bad. And from news reports, Trump himself was very unsettled by it. Now they're going away from a lot of the arguments that could be made about what the president actually said or, you know, what he really meant, and they're going to one argument in general they're going to hit this week, and that is unconstitutionality. He's not the president. It's unconstitutional. They're going to really hit home with that one. So that they've changed their strategy a bit.
I know it's a steep climb to get the numbers to have former President Trump impeached, but is there any chance whatsoever that the requisite number of Republicans would change their mind and decide to actually impeach?
I think there's zero possibility that they'll get the amount of numbers. Now, the only thing that would change that is if there was a silver bullet, but it would have came out by now, email where somebody in the White House said, we're gonna plan to have them storm the Capitol, then, of course, all bets are off. But otherwise, no, the numbers are not there. And again, the escape route for some people is the fact that he is not the sitting president. And I can tell you that neither side really wants to settle this issue, because think about this for a second, Rick. If you're Republican or you're Democrat, why would you not want to take this constitutionality issue to the Supreme Court for them to say? Well, that's because I think neither side really wants this to go on any longer.
Yeah, good point.
And neither does the president. He was asked about the impeachment today, and he said his press secretary also said he has not been glued to it.
Right. Well, speaking of President Biden, he did reach out to China. So how'd that go?
Well, this is interesting. Watching a lot of foreign policy statements by, you know, Biden administration and actions by the president himself, one of them I think could turn out to be not so good for the president potentially, and that's the reallowing of people to come in from Mexico that were remaining in Mexico. We can talk about that if you want, but the foreign policy call he made to China's Xi Jinping was 2 hours long. Mm. 2 hours. I mean, I don't talk to anybody for 2 hours. You know, I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of very interesting. They went over a wide variety of things, human rights in China, and of course, China is talking to us about nuclear proliferation, areas where we have mutual interests, mm-hmm. but also with the China policy when it comes to tariffs and trade. You know, so they had a long conversation. Now, the Biden administration has come out with a detailed plan, breaking it down of what they really are thinking about China itself. And there's basically five parts to it. So the interesting part is President Biden is working off the baseline of Trump's tariffs, of his tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
So Biden is keeping the baseline of what he's not undoing Trump's tariffs. That's a very smart move. And he's adding four other points, our own defense, our own innovation, our own technology, trying to improve us, and getting our allies in, you know, some type of uniform thought with us about approaching China. So those are the differences from Trump. But he is keeping the tariffs, which I think is very, very healthy in trying to leverage China.
I think it's
a successful call.
Yeah, and China in the news quite a bit. A little phrase with Australia, India, and now banning the BBC as kind of a fight back against the UK.
Right, and, you know, China has tried to do alliances with India, and if we are smart, we will beef up our approach to India. I mean, 1.2 billion people. I travel to India twice a year for the last 10 years. It's a country that has a lot of potential. It's a country that likes us. And so, you know, I think that any conflict China has with India, India should become our friend, you know, over it. It'd be very healthy for all of us. But China has now banned the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, has been banned from China. China still is a strong arm country. Now, isn't it interesting they kind of use the word fake news for the BBC? Wonder
yes.
where they got that from.
Yeah, they certainly did. They accused the BBC of not reporting the news factually from China. So the BBC, which doesn't have great presence in China, but has been banned,
right.
More kind of a ceremonial move. Bob Ney, we really appreciate these discussions
every week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Okay, maybe even after an hour of Chef Michael, you're not ready to attempt making a meal for your sweetheart on Sunday, or you just might need a backup plan if things go pear-shaped. We've thought of that, and we've got your plan B. Melissa Passanen is a food writer for 7 days and a wizard in the kitchen herself. This week, she's written an article in which she lets us know where to find some lovely takeout on Valentine's Day, and she's here with that intel. Melissa, it's always wonderful to have you on the show to save the day. Thanks for being here.
I appreciate that I'm put in such an important role. I hope
yes.
I can live up to that, Rick. Thanks.
I know you can. All right. So you went and looked to see, okay, who's going to have some takeout meals for Valentine's Day, which is important. But you picked some price points. What price points did you select for these takeout dinners?
Yeah, I mean, I thought this would be sort of a different way to do it because often Valentine's meals are pretty pricey.
Mm-hmm.
And this year especially, people may be watching their pennies. And I just wanted to show a variety. So we started, these are all for two people. So we started with under 30 or around 30 for two. And then 40, and then under 50, and then kind of shoot the moon, the sky's the limit. but it was a fun way to organize it. And then I really tried to also get like a diversity of types of food to represent the breadth that we have. These were all in Chittenden County, but everything from, you know, beautiful sushi to bowls of steaming Vietnamese pho, the soup with noodles, you know, to barbecue. You never know what you might be in the mood for.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to start with either the category that's either for somebody on a budget or for maybe it's a couple that have just stopped trying to impress one another. So let's start with the $30 category.
Yeah, so this one also brings up a really good point, which I hadn't really thought of until a restaurant owner. I also asked each restaurant owner or chef or whoever I was talking to at the restaurant for their own little Valentine's food traditions. Mm-hmm. And not to jump categories on you, Rick, but
right.
Sue Betty, who is the founder and managing partner of Bluebird Barbecue, said that she and her wife, for special occasions, they always go out for breakfast. And I thought, of course, breakfast in bed, or go out and order breakfast and pick it up. Mm-hmm. So Firebird Cafe in Essex Junction, which just has a great just delicious menu. I think you know them well Rick.
Oh, yes, I do.
The chef owner there, Jake Tran, is going to do like a special where you can get two of their breakfast or brunch specials, which they do all day. So you can stay in bed as long as you want. I think they're open till 7 on Sunday. And then you can also get your drink of choice. It might be pre-mixed mimosas if you're in that mood, or he also house roasts his Good Luck Coffee there, which is really amazing, at his sister location there, Nest. So that was, breakfast was a really good one to think of. And even if you don't get out for Firebird Cafe or other like full breakfast, like just some like special donuts and nice, you know, coffee would be really fun. There's several places in all over the state that do really great donuts. So it doesn't even have to be like a whole meal, just something special, right?
Right. Well, I do love that if anybody tells me, you know, it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I'm still laying around, and I'm just going to say, hey, Melissa Passanen said I can stay in bed all day on Sunday.
Especially on Valentine's Day.
That's right. All right. And some Vietnamese was another one for in the
$30. I will say, there's a lot of places that have really delicious pho. I picked Pho Son because I really love their pho. I also love Pho Hong, but they're not open Sunday. So that was an interesting issue with Sunday being Valentine's Day this year. There are several restaurants that I wanted to include that weren't open on Sunday. So including one that we might get to a little bit later that is taking an exception and being open on Sunday. But, yeah, I just those, you know, deep bowls of pho, just so restorative,
yeah.
And I could definitely see that they're pretty big, so you could even share one, and I invoked that famous Lady and the Tramp scene, which I'm sure everyone remembers of the two beautiful dogs slurping pasta, spaghetti in that case, but you could slurp the noodles together. And I loved what the owner there said. He said, Son Lei, he said that he didn't really have anything special planned for Valentine's Day, but his wife and his two little girls will be at the restaurant with him while he's preparing takeout orders. And he just said, food for us is happiness. And I just thought that was such a lovely way to think about it.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to climb the ladder to the $40 category where we have Mirabelle's and one of my favorites, Pizzeria Verita.
Yeah, so this one is a little bit take-and-bake theme. So Mirabelle's, which has, I'm sure folks know, just gorgeous baked desserts. They have some special stuff for two. I think the one that is so especially gorgeous is they have a one that looks sort of like Guy Fieri's hair, but in the form of a meringue covered cake. It's a vanilla sponge with passion fruit curd and cassis jelly, and they're making them kind of for two. So that's one awesome thing, and they, you know, you can just go there and pick those up. Obviously, they're, note that they're not open Sundays ever, so these would be things you pick up either today or tomorrow, Friday or Saturday. And they also have, in their new South Burlington location, they have take and bake meals, and I actually had this meal probably, I don't know, a month or so ago. They're doing a Valentine's special, which is crepes folded around chicken leeks, mushrooms, and vegetables in this lemon creme fraiche sauce. Delicious. So those, I strongly recommend that. And then you just bring those home, and they'll give you instructions how to heat them up. They're also doing a taco kit for two, which is sort of like a build-your-own, which gets to the Verita option, which I love. They have a couple different things going on, but the one I chose to highlight was they do these do-it-yourself pizza kits for two. They've been doing that out of their Soto Enoteca, which is what they've turned their little wine bar into for the pandemic. But they're doing those through Verita on the whole weekend. And they will give you, like, the dough, and they're doing two different toppings for Valentine's. One was a straight margarita, you know, their house-made mozzarella with basil and their own tomato sauce. But they're also doing a pizza. They do appropriately named for Valentine's, but it exists this way during the whole year, cherry amore. So it has dried cherries, arugula, sounds so good. They also have really yummy desserts, and you could add that on and still be under the price point. And they're doing Valentine's wine specials for like $12.50 a bottle, which sound really good.
Oh, no kidding.
So those were really fun, I thought.
All right,
you can actually do something, right? So it's activity.
That's right. All right, I'm going to pick just one in the $50 category. I'm going to go with Bluebird, where I could probably do damage to about $50 worth of their meat in one sitting. But
they have
Bluebird
a great deal for two, which is like $39.50, and it's really quite generous. Trio of meats, four sides. I would add, because I love them, the crispy Brussels sprouts. Those are just so good. And I think it's fun. Get messy, right?
Well, that's funny, because when I spoke with Chef Michael of Michael's on the Hill, I said, you probably want to avoid making or having something messy, you know, on a lovely romantic day like this. And he, like you said, no, get messy. You know, you're with someone you love. You can do that. You can be yourself and not have to worry too much about that.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, not like a first date where, you know, you don't want that piece of spinach stuck between your teeth, you know.
Right. Yeah.
That's a bad thing. All right, we're going to go to the Shoot the Moon category, and I want to start with Hen of the Wood, which is in Burlington, but we have one right here in Waterbury as well.
Yeah, so the way they do takeout, actually, as I joked or didn't really joke, caters to last-minute planners, because you cannot order ahead. You know, a lot of the places that were doing special Valentine's dinners, the order deadline is passed, unfortunately. But for them, their online ordering for the next day goes live the night before, late the night before. So they are doing their regular menu Saturday and Sunday, but also they have some specials. Shuck your own oysters, and as the chef de cuisine Jordan Ware called it, a bake-at-home situation for a Harbison cheese with maple sea salt crackers and apple butter. You know, that the oysters and the cheese for me, that's all I need.
No,
and
I'm kidding. I'm with you.
And then the second one was the Griffin, which is a downtown Burlington destination. They have great cocktails, and folks probably know this, but a lot of places are offering cocktails to go. You do have to order food. You can't just order the cocktails. And they have, like, their seafood grits are just kind of a classic, and they have some really fun cocktails. I wanted, if okay with you, Rick, to throw one more option
sure.
in the mix that
Absolutely.
I found out about. So this awesome chef that I know, Richard Whitting, he has a group called Isolé Dinner Club, and he does these really fun pop-ups, and he just told me they're doing a Casablanca-themed pop-up. The dinner part is sold out, but they're still doing the dessert sampler for two, and it's themed Casablanca, and you can still order it. If you go to Eventbrite, you can look up Casablanca Valentine's, and it's like they've got cheesecake, they've got madeleines, they've got a chocolate ganache with these special Czechoslovakian cookies, and it just sounds really fun, and you can still order it and then get it to pick up on Sunday. So if you go to Eventbrite, you can search, like I said, Valentine's Casablanca, and it's $30 for two, and it just sounds really fun. And then he tells you how you can find Casablanca. You know, you can even look at it via YouTube, I guess. You can watch it. So
right.
I thought that was sort of a fun activity, a little last-minute fun thing to still take advantage of.
Brilliant. Melissa, do you have plans? I'm not trying to ace out your husband. I'm just wondering what a food
well,
writer.
I am super lucky in that right now. I have a full house. I have my two boys both working from home. They're 20-somethings, and one of their girlfriends is also with us for, like, the late winter. So we actually ordered up a feast for five from Honey Road, so which I'm kind of super excited about. I was literally watching when was the ordering going to go live. I was going to cook. I was going to make fondue, which is what Allison Lane, of co-owner of Mirabelle's, does with her family. And then I was like, no, that menu looks really good. And Honey Road does have donuts, and you can do regular ordering from their menu on Sunday if people are interested in their food, obviously. But, yeah, I'm excited about that, I will say.
All right, some great ideas. Melissa Passanen is a food writer for 7 days, also a fabulous cook, and has written several cookbooks. You can find her story in this week's edition or at 7daysvt.com. And, Melissa, thanks so much for being on again.
Thank you, Rick. It was great fun.
Yeah, it really was. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to talk to a Vermonter who ran in the Daytona 500 a number of times. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly, the Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. It's race week here at WDEV, well, in Daytona, but we get pretty fired up about it here in Waterbury, too. Having a great track right here, Thunder Road in Barrie, has fostered that interest in auto racing here in Vermont. It's also provided a great place for drivers to test their mettle and see how far they can go. In one instance, that has led to the governorship here in Vermont for Phil Scott. In another, it has led to the Daytona 500 and a career driving on the NASCAR circuit. That individual is Kevin LePage of Shelburne, and he joins us now. Kevin, thank you so much for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, how are you doing this morning?
I'm great. How about you?
Good, thank you.
Listeners, if you'd like to ask Kevin about his driving at Daytona, or if you remember seeing him win the Milk Bowl, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kevin, I'm going to take you way back. Do you remember your first competitive race?
I do. It was back in 1980 at Catamount Stadium in Vermont, and I was 17 years old.
Wow.
And my brother had already started racing that season, and my dad wanted to give me a shot, so I ran the 35-lap race that was running that Saturday night at Catamount. I qualified. I won the heat race. Which was a big step for me since I've never been in a stock car before.
Oh,
and finished 10th in that feature. And unfortunately, that's where my career started, because that was a disappointing time in my family's life, because my brother was fired that Sunday morning and I replaced him.
Oh, my goodness. now Catamount, was that in Milton? Where was Catamount?
Yes, it was. It was in Milton, Vermont. It was a third-mile asphalt racetrack. Tom and Tom Curley and Ken Squire owned it. And so they would run weekly shows there. They would run Saturday night shows. 35 lappers, and then at Thunder Road they would run Thursday night 35 lappers. And so we started at that racetrack, and the rest is history.
Well, it was history. I mean, it was the start of history for you. But were you thinking then, man, I'm going to pursue this? This is what I'm going to do with my life?
Absolutely. When I was born, my mom said as a baby, my dad used to drag race, and I would, be in the race car or around the race car, all day long. And then, as I got older, I used to go to Catamount and stand, get in the grandstands and watch the race cars. And then I got the opportunity to race. And, through my high school career, all the kids up there, I kept telling them I'm going to be a NASCAR driver, NASCAR driver. And I went back after, about 10 years for a reunion, and they said, hey, you made it, you did it, it was, it was something that I wanted to, grow old in. And then when I got to be, where I am today, I wanted to be one of those guys, or gals to sit there and say, I made it, or at least I gave it a shot.
Yeah.
So many people go through life and they say, well, I wish I would have done this. I wish I would have pursued that. And you never have that opportunity if you don't try it.
Well, take us up the ladder, Kevin. So, you had that first race at Catamount, and then where do you climb after that initial race?
I was racing for my dad back from 1980 to the end of 1984. He got a divorce, so he shut down the race team. And in 1985, I was hired from a team in Maine to drive for them. And I drove for them 85, 86, and started the 87 season when the car owner during that winter picked up a partner. And they got in a big pissing contest early 87. So they shut the team, not shut the team down, but he bought them out. And I was fired. I think it was like the fifth or sixth race. I'd already won a race. I was like third or fourth in the points. Mm. And my replacement driver was Ricky Craven. I was living in Maine at the time. So I'm like, what am I going to do? And my dad still had a couple race cars, or I think one race car left. So I would travel back home Friday nights through the weekend to get this car ready to go back to the racetrack. And my first event was, I think, 5 weeks after I was released at Claremont Speedway. And I won that race, and the team that I was driving for, the new owner, Ricky didn't make the race that night. They had to buy a ride. So kind of got some satisfaction back. And so I raced for myself from 87 to 93. And at the end of the 93 season, Ken Squire got me some passes down in Rockingham, North Carolina, to go interview for a ride. He says, you basically have done everything you can up here, and I think it's the right time for you to to take the next step.
Mm.
And so we came down to Rockingham, my wife and I, and met with some car owners, and we had a really good chance of driving for somebody. And a couple of weeks later, we met with them again in Pennsylvania. They were talking to two drivers, myself and Mike Stefanik. And at the end of the day, they decided to go with Mike Stefanik because he was a modified champion, and they felt that he could do a better job, getting sponsors or whatever. So we came back home, and we were on the way home, and I said, why don't we go after Vermont Teddy Bear Company? John is a customer of mine, and let's try to present it to him. So John Sorrentino came into the shop, my dad's gas station there one day, and I said, hey, John, I says, what about going NASCAR racing with your company? And he fell in love with the idea. So we got the Vermont Teddy Bear sponsorship, and we came south and bought a race team, and started from there.
Oh, that's fantastic. So on these levels, Racing Thunder Road, ACT Tour, the Busch North Series, I'm guessing that at those levels you still had a day job. So what were you doing at that point?
I was working for my dad, gas station in Shelburne. I worked for him for quite a few years, and then I ended up opening up a repair shop in Shelburne to compete against my dad. We did more bigger jobs like doing engine changes and stuff. But I had a partner, myself and my future son-in-law at the time. And so we were able to, you know, work Monday through Thursday if we had to, and take Friday off to go travel to the races. And, you know, because back then we didn't fly to races. You know, we drove, and sometimes we had double headers and get back early Sunday morning or Monday morning and take a shower and go to work. So, you know, it was a lot of traveling, but, you know, it was a lot of fun, and it made me a better racer and a better person.
It had to be exhilarating at that point in your life. I know tiring, but you had to be just walking on air, you know, living in a cloud, doing what you really wanted to do for a living.
It was, because, you know, I was an owner driver back then, and even when I came south, you know, I was an owner driver until I was hired by David Ribbling in 1996. And, you know, the one race down here in at Richmond, Virginia, you know, we qualified very well, and Dale Jarrett and Dale Earnhardt Sr., both of them didn't make the race. You know, so when, you know, we had races like that where, you know, as an owner driver and underfunded team, I mean, even though we had the sponsorship from the Vermont Teddy Bear Company, you know, every dime that they gave us went into the race team. You know, we didn't take a paycheck. My wife didn't take a paycheck. You know, we didn't have RVs or, you know, big mansions. I mean, every dime that they gave us went into the race team. Mm-hmm. And so when we were on the racetrack and we did, you know, special things, you know, it made us feel real good.
Wow. Kevin, we've got a fan of yours on the line. It's Rusty DeWeese. Hey, Rusty.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, Kevin,
I got a couple. First of all, this show, excellent show where you can have in one show have the word fart said twice and pissing once. Fantastic. But anyway,
we're letting it fly here, man.
There's some people, there are probably some listeners out there right now who don't who maybe have never been to Thunder Road, Nation's Site of Excitement, and then Catamount. I was a kid, went to Catamount, home of the Brave. Could you just quick, don't want you to get too far away from your Daytona 500 experiences, but tell the folks out there, because you've been all over the United States racing, obviously, what in your mind makes Thunder Road such the fantastic thing to go see as a family? And thanks a lot. Good luck.
Love that question.
Thank you, Rusty, for the question. You know, Thunder Road has always been a special place in my heart. You know, it was a high bank. It is a high bank racetrack. You know, very narrow places. I mean, you really had to have your car right. And, you know, I fell in love with that place. And you know, when I won, you know, my third Milk Bowl there, you know, I did it from, you know, way in the back. You know, I think I got a total of 5 points. You know, ran on the outside, sometimes way on the outside. And, you know, it was just one of those racetracks that I just loved to race. And it made me a better race car driver because, you know, running the Milk Bowl, you had to make sure your car was there through the three segments. And so you had to take care of your equipment, and you had to make daring moves. So a lot of that I was able to carry south with us and you know, had a lot of success down here.
Kevin, I'm going to take you to 1998. You come close to winning Rookie of the Year, 14th in points, a sixth-place finish at Charlotte. What was that like for you?
You know, before we go there, Rick, I just want to give a shout-out to Ken Squire.
Yeah.
I heard he had a bad battle with COVID, but he's doing better. And, you know, I'm just glad that everybody's prayers came through. Back in 98, you know, it was an awesome year. When I first started, you know, to chase the Rookie of the Year, everybody didn't know who I was.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway through that season, I changed rides. Started driving for Roush Racing. And it came down to the last race of the year at Atlanta. And basically what the story was, whoever finished ahead of the other driver in the Rookie of the Standings, which was Kenny Irwin and myself at the time because Steve Park had gotten hurt, but whoever finished that race ahead of the other driver was going to win the Rookie of the Year. That's how close the battle was between Kenny and I. And it was a long day. We had a lot of rain, but Kenny ended up finishing like 12th or 13th, and I finished right behind him. And so, you know, we lost the Rookie of the Year battle. But, you know, Kenny and I were really good friends. We flew together quite a bit through the races. And when he got killed at New Hampshire, we flew to Indy for the funeral. Mm-hmm. And I walked up to pay my condolences to his parents, and his father says, "I know who you are. You almost took rookie of the Year away from Kenny, you know." So he says, "You guys, you know, became good friends, and Kenny spoke highly of you." So we had a really good time that year.
Beautiful. All right, we've got some calls. Nelson's calling from Barrie. Hi, Nelson.
Yeah, hello, Kevin. I find it interesting that you're a three-time Elk Bowl winner. Then a couple years ago there, you tried to go back to Thunder Road in the Day Boy Slate model, but didn't quite fare as well. What did you find the major difference from your success versus getting in that car? I mean, was it the cars changed, the track changed, the driver changed, or what was that like, all the changes that kind of, I think, hampered you a little bit?
Wow.
Well, you know, when, unfortunately, when I made the deal, there was a lot of promises. And when I got up here and talked with the crew chief, Mr. LeCaire, there was a lot of things that he had to do to the car to get it to the racetrack. And we just didn't have enough time to prepare it. Plus, you know, to be honest with you, I really thought that coming home to officially retire, that, you know, I was going to have a promoter's option. So there was some times, you know, through the races that I could have made a daring move if I knew I had to get in a race and rough somebody up. But I decided, hey, I'm just here to have some fun, you know, say thank you to the Thunder Road fans, the Vermonters, all my sponsors that were on the car that day. And it was just a way for me to come back and say thank you. So I actually thought that, you know, hey, I had an ace in my pocket, which, you know, that I was going to start, you know, at the back, you know.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen, you know. So I really have not officially retired from racing because I haven't run my last race yet, but I basically retired from racing.
Okay. I thought we were going to have some breaking news here. let's take another call. Dick's joining us from Waterbury. Hi, Dick.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead. Right ahead.
Hey, Kevin, tell us, what's it like? 200 miles an hour,
yeah.
Daytona, nose to tail, so much going on around you. Your reflexes got to be just incredible, and your blood pressure's got to be out of sight.
Well, the blood pressure's not out of sight because, you know, you can't run 4 hours in a race car at, you know, high blood pressure. Your heart just can't stand it. So my heart gets conditioned over the years to, you know, go up and then it settle back down and be calm, because you have to be calm in a race car. But, you know, my last Daytona 500, we took a car that would not qualify by itself but would race good. We raced our way in the 150s, finished third behind Tony Stewart and Jeff Burton. Ran that race all day long, kept our nose clean, ran up front, ran in the back, came back up through, and ended up finishing ninth, you know.
Yeah.
And to be the only Vermonter to finish in the top 10 in a Daytona 500. And realistically, if we hadn't had that late caution, we probably would have finished higher than that, because the car was just, we didn't have to lift. I mean, there's guys all around us, you know, Jeff Gordon and Earnhardt, they were lifting because, you know, cars weren't handling, but that car was just, you know, it was bad to the bone. But still a top 10 finish, you know, we were really excited about it. And, you know, back then you would have to find cars all day long to figure out which car you would run good behind. Today, the cars are so close and so competitive that, I mean, it's really hard to do that. So, you know, I just really enjoyed the old days of racing.
Yeah. Kevin, what's this week like for the drivers, the run-up to the 500?
You know, it's totally different than what it used to be. I mean, we were down in Daytona for almost 2 weeks. And then we were down there for a week of testing in January. So we would get down there for a solid week of testing, come back, cut our bodies up, put new cars together, maybe go to Talladega and test again, and then get to Daytona and then practice and qualify and run the 125s back then, and then he moved them up to the 150s. Well, today, I mean, that's all changed. I mean, they go in, you know, especially because of the COVID thing. I mean, they go in early in the morning, maybe one practice, maybe no practice, like the other day, just go out and qualify.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so their
schedules are totally different than what we used to do. So, but it's still the Daytona 500. I mean, yeah. Everybody wants to run the Daytona 500. I watched a little bit of the 150s last night, the one of them anyway. You know, there was some dicing going on. And I guess the second one, they had some wrecks in it where people were trying to get in the show. So, it's just totally different than what it was when I was there.
Did you have a favorite track or tracks on the circuit?
To be honest with you, all of them. Anyone that had grandstands and fans in the grands. You know, because I did it to, I was an entertainer, you know, it's just like a basketball player, a football player, right? Yeah. You're an entertainer and you don't want to go out and perform to nobody. And, you know, so like last year where there was no fans in the grandstands, I can't imagine what these guys are going through. Because I know when I was racing and we had a rain delay and there was nobody there on Monday, I mean, it was just devastating. You're just out there racing and you had a job to do because you had to, you know, race, but it was just the fans, you know, without listening to them cheer and then seeing them leave or, you know, it was just an amazing feeling. And so to me, every racetrack I had was the ones, that had people in the grandstands.
Oh, that's fantastic. Kevin LePage is, quite frankly, the fastest person I've ever spoken to in my entire life. Kevin, it's been an absolute pleasure having you today, so thanks so much.
All right, Rick, thanks for having me on, and all you Vermonters up there, stay warm. I know you got a lot of cold weather coming your way, and be safe up there.
All right, you too. Take care.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, so feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint at wdevradio.com. We've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference, and that's following CBS News. Today at 2 o'clock, we'll be back in D.C., for the Senate impeachment trial. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.